For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, I'd like to look at, as we open up here today, a new argument. Actually, it's an old argument that's been revived, called interlocking, the interlocking of the Gospels. Before we do that, I'd like to just go through some of the reasons why New Testament scholars believe that the New Testament is historically reliable. This is going to be a primer. It's going to be very quick and to the point, but I just don't want people to walk away thinking that interlocking is the best evidence or the only evidence. Let's just very quickly go through six different reasons why we would believe that the Gospels are reliable. The first would be the time frame. The time frame. What does that mean? Well, let's compare Jesus of Nazareth and the writings about him with other great historical persons. For example, Alexander the Great. He died in 323 BC. His earliest biography was written by a man named Arrian in AD 130. So 450 years after Alexander the Great dropped dead, Arrian wrote his biography. Now, do historians believe that we can know things about Alexander the Great? Of course they do. Of course they do. And yet we have a 450-year gap between his death and his earliest biography. What about somebody more contemporaneous with Jesus? Emperor Tiberius was the emperor alive during Jesus' days. He has two different biographies written by Roman historians, Suetonius and Tacitus. He died in AD 37. These date to the beginning of the 2nd century AD. So, roughly 70 years after his death. Jesus of Nazareth, an obscure, relatively obscure, itinerant Palestinian preacher who never traveled 100 miles from his birthplace, who never wrote anything, like some of the ancient Greek philosophers like Socrates, his disciples wrote his work. What do we have on him? We don't have one biography. We don't have two. We have four biographies on a carpenter in Palestine, Israel. And these date anywhere from AD 50 to AD 90. Now, I would date the Gospel of Mark to about AD 50. Not everyone would agree. Even critical scholars, however, would date all four Gospels to within the 1st century AD. So the time frame, the amount of time before the person died, and biographies about that person were being written, there's only a generation for Jesus. Secondly, the transmission of the text. We looked at this a little bit last night. This is some of the older data. In recent years, we found more copies of Homer and more copies of the New Testament. But Homer, about 600 copies, maybe as many as 800 today. Herodotus, 8 copies. Thucydides, 8 copies. Plato, 7 copies. The New Testament has 5,366 copies. Daniel Wallace says that if you stacked up all of these pages of text, it would be 2.5 million pages of text before the fall of Rome. So the New Testament, with its bibliographical information, all these different manuscripts with which we can compare, blows the other ancient documents out of the water. Just compare the New Testament with other documents from antiquity. Homer's Iliad compared to the New Testament. Homer's Iliad is the closest at about 643. The New Testament has about 9-10 times that much. And then we compare the approximate time span from when the document was written to later when we have our earliest known manuscript. And the New Testament is way quicker as well. Homer's Iliad, you have to go 500 years before you get your earliest manuscript. Sophocles, you have to go 1,400 years from when Sophocles wrote to our earliest manuscript of Sophocles. Tacitus, Caesar, and so forth. The New Testament, we have a manuscript of the Gospel of John, chapter 18, verses 31 to 33. A little fragment that dates within 20 to 30 years of when John wrote that Gospel. We have full books of the Bible by AD 200, and then we have full New Testaments within 300 years. So the transmission of the text is very good. What about other texts? Some people say, well, you're being prejudicial to pick Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Why not the Gospel of Mary? Why not the Gospel of Thomas? Why not the Gospel of Peter? Well, I'd like to give you three reasons why. Historians wouldn't view those as good historical records of the life of Jesus of Nazareth. The first is that all of the Gnostic Gospels, all date at least to the mid-second century, that's AD 150, or later. Once you get into the Gospel of Philip, you're getting into way hundreds of years later. So historians ask themselves, why would we prefer Gospels, biographies, which date hundreds of years later to the first century manuscripts? Second, the Gnostic Gospels, one of the best arguments against them is to read them. They are some of the most fanciful, bizarre. We read in one of our systematic theology classes here at our church, we read through parts of the infancy of Thomas. It's about Jesus just going around killing other kids and threatening his father, and it's hilarious. Anyways, when you read the Gospel of Thomas, which is the earliest Gnostic Gospel, it dates to about AD 150, we don't have a biography. What we have are 114 lines that are attributed to Jesus, 114 verses of Jesus' teaching. You compare this with the four Gospels, which contain Jesus of Nazareth's teaching, but it also places it into a historical milieu, a historical backdrop. So-and-so was the governor. So-and-so was the procurator. So-and-so was the emperor. So-and-so was the high priest. At about this time, in about this era, in this geographical region, the Gospel of Thomas has nothing like this. Just a list of Jesus' supposed sayings. And then also we find that the Gnostic Gospels are misogynistic. Messene means to hate. Gune means women. So misogyny means the hatred of women. What do I mean by this? Well, we read in the Gospel of Thomas, line 114, Simon Peter. Now, if you know Peter from the Gnostic or the biblical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you know Peter's a little bit of a wild card, we might say. Simon Peter said to Jesus, "Let Mary leave us, for women are not worthy of life." He's not that much of a wild card in the four Gospels. I mean, he says some kind of wild thing. Nothing like that. Nothing like that. And so we would expect Jesus, you know, who had women disciples, Jesus who loved women, who cared for the marginalized, we would expect Jesus to come in with a quick reproof. Instead, Jesus says, "I myself shall lead Mary in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." Jesus is arguing for a first century sex change so that women can get into heaven. There's no such thing as female people going into heaven. This was the culture at the time. Women were treated like dirt. Misogyny was rife throughout Israel. That's true. That is the case. Jesus is nothing like that. So I'm asking the question, which would make more sense? A gospel which depicts a Jesus which is totally unlike his culture, or a Jesus that fits directly in with his culture? Number four, trivial details. Are you liking the alliteration? It's like a bunch of cows. Trivial details. All right, Colin J. Hemer. He was a classicist who turned into a New Testament historian. In his book, which is really a tour de force, the Book of Acts against the setting of Hellenistic history, he died before the final two chapters could be written. And this book is just phenomenal. He cites 180 undesigned coincidences between Luke and Acts in secular history. So we're talking about a travel of 450 miles. This is before Google. This is before Wikipedia, where Luke says, Paul went here, Paul went there, Jesus went here, Jesus went there. And he lines it up with the time and place, and he discovers that this is lockstep with ancient history. So once we try and compare the Bible with extra biblical testimony, we see it very clearly. It lines up. Number five, testimonies, hostile testimonies. Imagine you went into court and you got four of your friends to be on the court case to, you know, support you in your testimony. Let's call those friends Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're really friendly to you. They believe in you, and they're coming up to support you. But let's say, by contrast, you had six enemies, hostile testimonies against you. Let's call these six Suetonius, Josephus, Cornelius, Tacitus, the Babylonian Talmud. That doesn't fit that well in my illustration. Pliny the Younger and Lucian of Samosata. These are anyone from Jewish sources to Roman sources to political sources to historians or even Greek satirists. In the case of Lucian, Tacitus in his Annals, book 15, section 44, he says that Christians got their name from Christus, who suffered the extreme penalty, which would have been crucifixion. And that Christianity has made its way all the way up to Rome. Josephus and his Antiquities of the Jews, book 18. In the shorter version, there was an interpolated version, a messed with version, which we don't believe, nobody believes, critics or Christians, was original to Josephus. But a shorter version, which talks about Jesus, who was called a miracle worker, who was raised from the dead, according to his disciples, Suetonius, Pliny the Younger. I mean, we could go right down the line, and here we have a picture of Christians worshiping Jesus, believing he was risen from the dead, suffered execution under Pontius Pilate and Emperor Tiberius in the same time frame, and these are not Christians. I mean, you read their works, and they're hostile to Christianity. Finally, number six, trustworthy witnesses. Trustworthy witnesses. You might say, well, yeah, I'm only going to listen to the hostile sources of the New Testament. Well, why would you do that? If you drop dead today and someone was trying to write a biography about you, should they only interview your enemies? No, they would miss out on many of the key details about your life. And so we should, you know, not without criticism, not without being critical and critically minded, but we should take the friendly witnesses to Christ, and there's reasons why. For one, they recorded embarrassing details both about themselves as well as about Jesus. At one point in John chapter 8, John records that they were calling Jesus demon-possessed. Now, why would he include that unless he had a commitment to telling the truth? You don't say that about someone that you love, like Jesus. Matthew chapter 11, Jesus is accused of being a drunkard. Why would you include that? That's an embarrassing detail. How about embarrassing details about the disciples themselves? In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus turns to Peter and he says, "Get behind me, Satan!" He called Peter Satan, is what he did. Why would you include that? He's one of the leaders of the early church. So this would pass a criterion of authenticity, which historians believe boosts the validity, the verifiability of these documents when you include embarrassing details. Secondly, they didn't put words into Jesus' mouth. Think about all of the early discussions that we see in primitive Christianity. Should Gentiles be circumcised? You know, that discussion was had in about, I don't know, AD 50, AD 51, Acts chapter 15. Why is it that we don't have a single word in the four Gospels about circumcision from Jesus? He doesn't mention that. Wouldn't it be nice, I mean, if you're at a council of all these Christian leaders and thinkers, if you were like making up the Gospels, wouldn't it be nice just to have like a Matthew 29 where you just scribble in, and then Jesus said, the Gentiles don't need to be circumcised. Or then he said, they should be circumcised. He doesn't mention anything about it, which shows me that these New Testament authors didn't feel the liberty to put words into his mouth. They wanted to record what he actually said. Also, the gospel authors abandoned millennia-old traditions. Like what? Like temple sacrifice, like a temple worship, like a strict Unitarian monotheism rather than a Trinitarian monotheism, believing that Jesus was the God-man, truly God and truly man, things like that. I mean, this would be like going into Amish country this week and then going back a year later and you're seeing that they're all dressed in blue jeans and, you know, punk rock t-shirts and piercings all over their lips. And, you know, they've thrown out their Bibles. They're reading Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. You'd be like, what happened here? Why the change? Whatever the change was, it must have been that they were convinced that their former way of life was not in line with what God was doing through the person of Jesus. And then finally, Jesus' closest disciples suffered and died for their beliefs. I don't say all 12. They may have. I would feel more comfortable saying that Jesus' 12 disciples were willing to die for their belief in Jesus. We just don't have good historical records for all of them. The ones we do have good historical records for are Jesus' closest disciples, namely Paul, Peter, and James, Jesus' brother. Both Paul and Peter are said to be martyred extra-biblically in AD 95. That's the source from First Clement of Rome. And Clement says that they were both martyred in Rome. So we have good testimony that they were killed. And as far as James, the brother of Jesus, Josephus, the non-Christian Jewish historian, says that James, the brother of Jesus, the so-called Christ, was stoned to death by the Jewish Sanhedrin. So an extra-biblical source saying that James went to his death in belief in his brother. Now, many of us here have brothers. How much would it take for you to believe that your brother was the sinless son of God who came to rescue the sins of humanity? Probably take quite a lot. How much would it take for you to go to your death being thrown from a temple height and then stoned to death, bludgeoned to death for that belief? So these would be six reasons that we would believe that the New Testament is historically reliable. Now let's move to the icing on the cake. I don't want to presume that this is the best evidence or the only evidence, but I think it is a very good evidence, which has been frequently overlooked. I'm speaking, of course, of interlocking in the New Testament. What am I talking about? Well, let's give a quick definition. Interlocking is a term used by New Testament scholarship to refer to when two or more authors explain one another without intending to, with throwaway comments. So let me repeat that. When two or more authors explain one another without intending to, with these little casual throwaway comments. So one author, let's say Matthew, raises a question, and you read Matthew, and you're like, what is he talking? Why does he? That's such a cliffhanger. What's going on there? And then you read Mark, and you go, ah, once I get not the two-dimensional flattened out picture, I get the three-dimensional stereoscopic picture here. It comes into 3D, and I start to discover that's why Matthew said that, or that's why Mark said that, or that's why John said that. These are sometimes referred to as undesigned coincidences. Undesigned coincidences. So it's not just coincidences, because two of the authors could be working together with collusion. These are undesigned coincidences. You get the sense, as you read through the accounts, that he wasn't trying to prove him, and he wasn't trying to prove him. Okay, let me see if I can make this real concrete. Let's think about a fictional story about meeting Nick Offerman. You might be like, who's Nick Offerman? He's Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec. You're like, why would you pick such an obscure person for your illustration? Well, because I think that he is a very talented actor and really a pretty handsome man when it comes down to it. All right. Nick Offerman, Ron Swanson, you go into work this week. You have two coworkers, one of whom is named John and the other is named Jill. And you're getting coffee first thing Monday morning and you're talking to John and you're like, hey, John, how was your weekend? And he says, it was great. He says, man, I'm a huge fan of Parks and Rec. And so Jill, my wife, took me to see Nick Offerman. And you're like, who's Nick Offerman? Ron Swanson. Oh, yeah, Parks. Okay, cool. He says the tickets were sold out, so we got scalped tickets. We talked to a very nice person at the door, and we got scalped tickets. Okay. Then he says Nick Offerman invited us backstage with him. We got to hang out with him. We got to talk to him. It was awesome. But guess what? He shaved his mustache for the show. It was hilarious. Friend, everyone's staring at me. I thought that was funny. All right, friend number two. We met Ron Swanson. This is a lunch. You're talking to John's wife, Jill. We met Ron Swanson. You're like, oh, yeah, yeah. I was talking to John over coffee this morning. How was it? She says, well, I didn't recognize him at first, but John recognized his voice. And actually, I had forgot that it was John's birthday, so I had to do some last-minute work to get the tickets and so forth. And she said, we were actually even late to the show because we had to stop at the ATM to get cash. But we ended up seeing the show, and we ended up meeting him. Now, what if you're like a real skeptic of this account? Like, you met the handsome Nick Offerman. That's what you're telling me? How do we know? Well, there's a number of ways you could know. You could say, well, let's see the tickets. Let's see some pictures. When was this documented? Or there's a way of comparing the story to show, not demonstrably, not 100%, that there are features of this story that add up without intending to. So what's the main claim of John and Jill's story? It's that they met this actor, comedian, at a comedy club. Okay, now let's compare the story. She says it was John's birthday. So what was she trying to do? She's trying to do something special and nice for John, and she knew he was a huge Parks and Rec fan, and so she took him to go see Nick Offerman. Now, she doesn't mention the fact that he's a huge Parks and Rec fan, and he doesn't mention the fact that it was his birthday. But when you lay the accounts side by side, you start to discover those interlock with each other. He says, I'm a huge Parks and Rec fan, and so he calls the actor by his real name, Nick Offerman. Presumably, Jill is not a huge Parks and Rec fan, and so what does she call him? Ron Swanson. She doesn't know his name. That would seem to fit. He's the fan, she isn't. What about this scalping business? Tickets were sold out, so we got scalped tickets. That's all he says, a little throwaway comment. Jill comes in and says, I forgot about his birthday. I had to do something last minute. And we had to stop at the ATM to get cash. Now, why would she mention that, the ATM? Presumably because scalpers don't take card. They take cash. Why does she mention the last minute? Well, it seems to fit with the idea that they got scalped tickets for his birthday. What about this? He shaved his mustache for the show. He didn't look like Nick Offerman. And then Jill says, I didn't recognize him at first, but John recognized his voice. Jill doesn't mention the lack of mustache, making that guy look totally different, by the way. Google it. And then John doesn't mention the fact that he recognized the voice. But when you put these side by side, you discover that these are in line with each other. Is this making sense? You with me? Undesigned coincidences or interlocking in the New Testament. I've got about 15 of these. There's more. Let's start with the birth of Jesus. Why did the religious leaders accuse Jesus of being born of fornication in John 8:41? Well, this would pass the criterion of embarrassment, which I mentioned earlier, that this was actually said. I mean, why would they include this in their accounts? Your mother was promiscuous. You were born of fornication. Why would they level that charge against Jesus? Well, this is an easy one to answer, because as Bible readers, we know Matthew and Luke record that Jesus was born of a virgin. Now, Matthew and Luke don't record that the religious leaders were saying that Jesus had a promiscuous mother, and John doesn't mention the virgin birth. But when you put the two accounts side by side, you discover that these are matching and interlocking to explain each other. Do you think that the religious leaders would have bought the virgin birth story? Of course not. And John just gives you this throwaway comment that lines up in support of Matthew and Luke. What about the baptism of Jesus? John the Baptist in John chapter 1, verse 34 says, I have seen myself and have testified that this is the Son of God. Now, how does John know that Jesus is the Son of God? John doesn't record the words spoken in the synoptic gospels. I'm speaking, of course, of synoptic. Syn means together. Optic means to see. So they say Matthew, Mark, and Luke are synoptic. They generally see together. And then John is the outlier. 90% of John is unique to John. So John 1:34 says that John the Baptist says, this is the Son of God. Well, where does he get that term from? John doesn't tell us. When we read the synoptic gospels, we discover that at Jesus' baptism, and guess who was there at the baptism? John the baptizer was there, baptizing Jesus. He hears from heaven, this is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. John the Baptist must have heard that voice from heaven and said, this is the Son of God. Now, John doesn't mention the baptism. All he gets is the Son of God part. The synoptic gospels don't mention the other thing, but they fit together into an interlock. Okay, gets better. Calling of Peter. Does it ever bother you in Matthew chapter 4, that Peter just immediately sees Jesus and Jesus says, hey, you, follow me. And he's like, okay, immediately drops his nets and follows him with his brother Andrew. Am I the only one that bothers? Bothers me quite a bit. As Jesus was walking by the Sea of Galilee, he sees two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, follow me, I will make you fishers of men. And immediately they left their nets and followed him. What is going on here? If all you had was Matthew, and remember, if you were in the early church, that might be the only gospel you have. You're reading Matthew, immediately he starts to follow Jesus. Huh? Was there a halo above Jesus' head? What was it? Was there a light that just followed him? I guess we should follow him. Except when we compare this with John's account. John chapter 1, verse 41, we discover that in Matthew chapter 4, that is not the first time that Peter had met Jesus. This was the second time they had met. Andrew found first his own brother Simon and said to him, we found the Messiah, which is translated as the Christ. Andrew brought Peter to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and he said, you are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas. And then Jesus walks away. Peter must have been like, this guy's the Messiah. He knows who I am, and he just renamed me. Okay? Then however many years later or months later, I don't know, he bumps into him and he says, follow me, I'll make you fishers of men. And immediately they drop their nets. No wonder, because they had seen him before. Okay, so that's how John explains Matthew. Now we flip over to Luke chapter 5. This is the same event. It ends with that statement from Jesus, follow me, I will make you fishers of men. We discover in Luke chapter 5 that this statement from Jesus comes after Jesus goes up to Peter and Andrew and says, hey boys, let's go out on the lake and catch some fish. Peter says, well, we can't. We've been throwing our nets out all day, all night. We're not going to catch anything, but whatever. If you say we should go, we'll go. Jesus takes them out. It says that they had a huge catch of fish. And remember, Peter turns to Jesus and says, flee from me because I'm a sinful man. And Jesus has more words with him. And then he says, follow me, I will make you fishers of men. No wonder he drops his net right after that statement is made. What about the calling of James and John? This is in the same section. Matthew 4:24. This one is really cool. Check this out. Jesus saw two other brothers, James and John of Zebedee, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets, and called them. That is a throwaway comment. What else do fishermen do besides mend their nets? They're mending their nets, and then it says, immediately, they get up, leave their boat and their father, and follow Jesus. In the first century, to leave your sustenance, to leave your profession, and then just what? Leave your parents too? Oh, that was an unforgivable sin. And follow this random guy. How does that make any sense? Except when we compare it with Luke. Check this out. He said to Simon, put out into the deep water, let down your nets for a catch. And when they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish. Now catch this. And their nets began to break. And you're like, well, I see what you're trying to do here. This says that James and John's nets were broken and they were mending their nets, not Peter and Andrew. Hold on. Verse 7, Peter and Andrew signaled to their partners, I can't do a whistle. Is there a man in the room that can actually do one? All right, yeah, thank you. You just shamed me, by the way. Okay, so they whistle. Peter and Andrew signal their partners to the other from the other boat for them to come and help them. They came and filled both of the boats so that they began to sink. So does that make sense as to why I would say that their nets were broken? And after this huge catch, they're going there fixing their nets back together? Makes perfect sense. Now, again, I hope you track with this. Matthew doesn't explain the huge catch of fish. Luke doesn't mention the mending of nets. But when we put them together, we see that these interlock in a unique way, which explains the problem. What about the feeding of the 5,000? Does it ever bother you in Mark chapter 6, verse 39, that Mark refers to the grass as green? What color is it supposed to be? Purple? Maroon? Grass is green. Why does he mention green grass? Until we flip over to the Gospel of John. John chapter 6, verse 4 says that the feeding of the 5,000 was during the Passover. You're like, I don't get it. What's the point? Did you know that in Israel, in such an arid, deserted place as Israel, that the grass is usually dry, it's usually killed 9 months out of the year. It's usually not green, it's fried, it's completely dead, except in the very late winter and in the early spring. There's a small window, about 2 to 3 months, in which the grass turns from being, dry and dead to being green and healthy. And that is precisely the time that the Jewish Passover occurs. So Mark mentions the green grass, but he doesn't mention the time. John mentions the time, but doesn't mention the green grass. To add insult to injury, in the feeding of the 4,000 by Mark, which comes up later in the gospel, I believe chapter 8, can't remember. In the feeding of the 4,000, Mark doesn't mention any green grass. He just says that he had them sit down on the ground. Here's another one from the feeding of the 5,000. Why does Jesus ask Philip where to buy bread? Who's Philip? Anyone even know who Philip is? I mean, Bible readers here. You're like, yeah, he's one of the disciples. Yeah, can you tell me anything about him? He's one of the disciples. I really don't know. Feeding of the 5,000, he turns to Philip. Now, Philip comes up in John 1, John 6, and John 14. He's the one that says, show us the Father, and so forth. But we read in John chapter 6, verse 5, that Jesus turns to Philip. He picks him out. Philip, where are we supposed to buy bread so that these people may eat? Why does he pick out Philip? Well, let's flip over to Luke and his account, Luke chapter 9. It says that the feeding of the 5,000 occurred in Bethsaida. Bethsaida. That still doesn't answer it at all. Wait a minute. Where was Philip from? According to John 1:44, Bethsaida. When I read this, I got goosebumps. Do you see what this is saying? Jesus is walking through, and according to John, John says Philip's from Bethsaida, and he also says that Jesus turned to Philip to ask him where we should buy food. But he doesn't tell us that the feeding of the 5,000 occurred in Bethsaida, only Luke does. Luke doesn't mention that Philip's from Bethsaida, only where the miracle occurred. So what's the picture? It's like Jesus is in Bethsaida, and he's looking around, and he's like, who should I pick? Peter, the most popular disciple? John, James, the inner three, one of the popular? No. Who's from around here? Philip, where should we go buy bread? And Philip's just like, and then the young lad comes forward, and guess who brings him forward? Andrew. Guess where Andrew's from? Bethsaida. So John mentions that it happens in Bethsaida, John mentions that they're from Bethsaida, but doesn't tell us where the miracle occurred. Luke tells us where the miracle occurred, but doesn't tell us that they were from Bethsaida. What about healing possessed people? We read in Matthew chapter 8, verse 14, Jesus came into Peter's home. He saw his mother-in-law lying sick in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she got up and waited on him. When evening came, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were ill. Anybody have a problem with that? Jesus is an itinerant, that is to say, a traveling teacher. He never sits down for too long. He's always traveling from town to town to town. And he comes into this village and he heals a woman who is on the brink of death. And the people in the village hear about this. Jesus, the miracle worker, healer, is here. And they wait until evening to bring them the sick and the people who are in need of healing, demon-possessed. Why would you wait until evening? That makes no sense whatsoever. Unless it's the Sabbath, which Mark tells us. To carry a person or to travel on the Sabbath was considered a sin in the first century Jewish religious culture. Of course they waited until evening. They weren't allowed. They're probably waiting for that sun to go down, like, okay, 30 seconds. Go, we got to go get him. And they bum rushed Jesus and had him heal all their friends. What about the sending of the 12? Matthew lists the 12 in Matthew chapter 10, verse 2, in pairs. Check this out. Simon, who's called Peter, with Andrew, his brother. So those are paired. And these in the Greek are paired off. It's the word used here, it's Peter and Andrew. Okay, there's no punctuation, but the syntax, the structure is Peter and Andrew are paired. And then James and John are paired. So that's two pair. Philip and Bartholomew, three pair. Thomas and Matthew, four pair. James and Thaddeus, five pair. And then Simon must have drawn the short straw. He gets with Judas, the one who betrayed him. Now, when we look at this, usually when I read through these lists, my Bible reading, I skim right through them. I don't really see too much value there. Okay, it's the list of the guys. They're paired off. What's interesting is that Mark gives a list as well in Mark chapter 3, verse 16, and yet Mark doesn't have them paired off like this. Only Matthew does. However, Mark 6, 7 says that Jesus sent out his disciples two by two. So track with me here. Matthew doesn't say that they were sent out two by two, but he lists them two by two. Mark doesn't list them two by two, but says that they were sent out two by two. They're both undesigned connections that confirm one another. All right, Herod's private conversation. You see how this is a cumulative case? There's 30 of these. I could just keep going. I'll get to that later. I better be quiet. Herod's private conversation. How did they know what Herod was talking about with regard to John the Baptist? Matthew 14. It says Herod is freaking out about John the Baptist, and he spoke these private comments to his servants. How did the New Testament authors know what Herod said? Did they have bugs put into the oil lamps in his palace? What did they do? Did they have people with binoculars and listening in? No, they had a mole. Luke chapter 8, verse 3, it says, Joanna, the manager of Herod's household, one of his servants, had become a disciple of Jesus. So she was a secret infiltrator. Now, Matthew records this private conversation, and Luke doesn't. Luke records that Joanna was a member of Herod's household, and Matthew doesn't. But when we put them together, we discover she was in there, presumably taking notes. What about Jesus' triumphal entry? We're going chronologically here, right through Jesus' life. John, in John chapter 12, says that the triumphal entry, where Jesus comes in, Hosanna in the highest, Psalm 118, they're putting down the palm branches, remember? It says that the triumphal entry happened 6 days before the Passover. 6 days before the Passover. So he gives us the time marker. From triumphal entry to the Passover, 6 days. Mark doesn't tell us 6 days. He doesn't mention that. What Mark does from Mark 11 to 14 is give us a sequential day-by-day account that first the triumphal entry and then it was sundown. Then on the next day, they woke up, they did this, they did that, and it was sundown. Then the next day, sun up, sundown. Then the next day, sun up, sundown. And then it says, and they were 2 days from the Passover. So John says 6 days, doesn't give you the sequence. Mark gives you the sequence, but doesn't give you the 6 days. So it lines up together. What about the Last Supper? Ever bother you why Jesus, out of the blue, just starts to wash the disciples' feet? in John 13? I mean, we know what he's doing. We know he's trying to model humility, but why that? Why does he do it then? We flip over to Luke 22. This is at the same time at the Last Supper. Luke 22, 24. There arose also a dispute among them as to which one of them was regarded to be the greatest. Did you realize that at the Last Supper, the disciples were bickering over which one was the greatest? And Jesus gets up in verse 27. Who is greater, the one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as the one who serves. So isn't that three-dimensional picture there? You've got the disciples bickering about which one of them is the greatest. And they've already had this argument before. Mark 10, they're all arguing about who is the greatest. And here they are again, the night of Jesus' betrayal. And they're arguing over which one is the greatest. And Jesus just slowly gets up and pulls out the basin and starts to wipe the crud and the filth from beneath their toenails. They line up. Jesus' trial. Why does Pilate ask if Jesus is the king of the Jews out of the blue? This one's okay. Not that great, honestly. Luke 23 says that this charge was leveled at Jesus in front of Pilate. Luke 23, verses 1 through 3. And that's why Pilate knows that Jesus is the king of the Jews. What about this one? Oh, this is good. Check this out. How could Jesus say that his followers wouldn't fight to make him king when that very night Peter chopped off the ear of Malchus? How does this work? John 18, this has always cracked me up, this account here. John 18, 10, Simon Peter then, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear, and the slave's name was Malchus. So the other accounts tell us that, actually, the beginning of John 18 tells us that they sent a Roman centurion, so 1,000 guards show up to come capture King Jesus, and Simon Peter's like, I got this, and he pulls out a sword, and he goes up to a soldier, a general, a command, no, to a slave, a little, and he goes, ugh, and he cuts off his ear, and it's like the mighty Peter, this is your moment, man, and he hacks off his ear, and Jesus is just like, dude, don't. Okay, flash forward. Okay, so Peter did attack that guy, though. Okay, then he's in the room with Pilate, verse 36. He's talking to Pilate. My kingdom is not of this world, he says. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. That's a blit. There you go. Atheism.com, there's a blatant contradiction. We should send that to him. They were fighting in verse 10. In verse 36, Jesus says, no, that's not my kingdom. If it were, my servants would be fighting. We flip over to Luke, and we discover only in Luke that Jesus healed that poor servant's ear. What does that mean? That means that they couldn't bring Malchus forward as an eyewitness. Now, John mentions the cutting off of the ear, and he mentions that he says, no, my kingdom is not of this world. My servants do not fight. But only Luke is the one that mentions that he healed it. And so we put these together and we discover Jesus could make that statement. Because I'm sure Malchus didn't feel bad toward Jesus. After all, he just had his ear healed. So he wouldn't have been a witness. Why does Pilate not care that Jesus claims to be the king of the Jews? This one is good too. Check this out. Pilate asks Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? You're on trial with the Roman governor. He's standing there. Are you the king of the Jews? Are you seditious? Are you a threat against Rome? Are you going to try and lead an uprising? 40 years later, this is the very thing that brought the legions of Rome down on Israel and resulted in the Jewish war and the destruction of the Jewish temple. This was a huge charge, capital punishment. Are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus says, Sulege. It is as you say. Or it's translated, you have said so. Or it's translated, yes, it is as you say. Or NLT, I like, you said it. And then we read this. Pilate immediately tells the chief priests, I find no guilt in this man. What? Are you guilty against Rome? Should you be trying? Are you leading an uprising? Are you a king? And then he's like, you said it. I find no guilt in this man. What? Was Pilate high when this happened? What is going on here? What is it? Well, in the intervening argument in John 18:36, Jesus says to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would be fighting. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." And then he says, "I speak the truth." And then Pilate says, "What is truth?" And walks out. Remember the account? What does Pilate think Jesus' kingdom is like? Does he think it's a political kingdom? No. He thinks that he might be some philosopher king, some kind of spiritual authority, but he's flatly denying that I'm a threat to Rome. My servants won't fight. I'm not going to lead an insurrection. It's a spiritual kingdom. And it's in that context that Pilate comes out and says, "I find no guilt in this man." In other words, he's your problem. If you have a problem with his spiritual claims, that's not a problem with Rome. That's a problem with Judaism, and that's in your jurisdiction. You see how these line up together so beautifully? Jesus' trial. Why do false witnesses say Jesus would destroy the temple? They say, Mark chapter 14, verse 58, that Jesus would destroy this temple and in 3 days he will build another. When did Jesus ever make that claim in Mark or Matthew? Never makes that claim. He only makes that claim in John at the beginning of his ministry. The claim comes from John, but that doesn't come up at his trial. The accusation in his trial comes up, but we don't have the claim in the synoptics. But when you put them together, you discover, and in fact, Mark even says that they have this garbled version of what Jesus said. Why? John 2 is at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. The trial is at the end. It's been 3.5 years. They can't get it right. What about this one? Why would the religious leaders ask Jesus to prophesy who hit him? Matthew 26:67, they spat in his face and beat him with their fists, and others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is the one who hit you?" What kind of a question is that? You're getting slapped. Predict who hit you. That doesn't make any sense until you discover in Mark 14 and Luke 22 that Jesus was blindfolded. If all you had was Matthew, that statement would make no sense. But you compare it with Mark and with Luke, it makes perfect sense. How did Peter gain access to the high priest's courtyard? That just seems impossible. How could he get back there? We discover in John 18 that Peter knew one of the high priest's disciples, and so he got access that way. If all you had was Mark, that would make no sense. John explains Mark. The crucifixion. Why does Jesus commit his mother to the care of the beloved disciple? In this culture, you wouldn't give the care of your mother to one of your friends. You give the care of your mother to one of your brothers, to one of your family. They were very family inclusive. Why would he do that? Woman, behold your son. Son, behold your mother. Well, we discover in the beginning of John and in the Synoptic Gospels that Jesus' brothers weren't believers. Jesus didn't trust them. He did trust John. And so we put these together. That seems so strange that he would do that, except when we compare the accounts. This one isn't that good because John 7 is part of the same gospel. But again, it's a throwaway comment that bears more explanation. What about the restoration of Peter? Why does Jesus repeatedly ask Peter, "Do you love me more than these?" in John 21:15. He keeps asking. How many times? 3 times. Well, we flip over to Matthew 26 and Mark 14, and it says, "Even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away." And Jesus says, after his resurrection and the restoration of Peter, "Do you love me more than these? Even though they'll all fall away, I'll never fall away. Do you love me more than these?" He denied him 3 times. He asks them this question 3 times. Well, we could think of it like this, like a puzzle. You know, I guess what I'm arguing here is it's like these jigsaw puzzles getting pieced together. And at first, they just seem like disparate, separate pictures, and yet over time you start to discover as they're snapped together that they're really giving you the same picture of the same person in the same way, Jesus Christ. These are 4 separate eyewitnesses that are giving incidental throwaway details that are explaining each other. Which brings us to our conclusions. These examples, I know you may have been a little bit tired of going through example after example after example. Actually, I cut about half of them. There's more. But I wanted to do is to give you a cross-sectional from Jesus' birth all the way through his resurrection. This brings up the key events in his life: his birth, his baptism, the calling of his disciples, miracles, conversations, triumphal entry, Last Supper, trial, death, and resurrection. We find these undesigned coincidences or interlocking in basically the core history of Jesus' life. So too, these include many of the miraculous events in Jesus' life. Here's that same list. More than half of those undesigned coincidences occur in the presence of miracle accounts. So it's not like all the undesigned coincidences match up in non-miraculous historical parts. It's actually spread evenly all the way through, almost as if we have four independent witnesses that are talking about the same events from different perspectives, and they're lining each other up. These can't be explained by collusion. Here's why I really like this argument, because it's become very popular today for critics and skeptics to throw accusations against the Gospels, and specifically that they contradict each other. They always say that. In fact, you hear critics claim things like, well, Judas in Matthew 27, it says that he was hanged, and then Acts chapter 1:18, it says that he was burst open and fell on the ground. So it's a contradiction. First of all, that's not a contradiction. A contradiction is A equals non-A, not A equals B or something else. A contradiction would be Judas hanged himself, Judas did not hang himself. But let's just say, let's go with them on that. They're saying, yeah, Matthew was too idiotic, too oblivious, too stupid, too careless to check with Luke to see how Judas died. Or let's say Luke was written after Matthew. Luke was too stupid, idiotic, or oblivious to check with Matthew to see how Judas died. What this argument shows is that the critic has to say, well, how did all these undesigned coincidences come about? Well, the gospel authors were so sly, they were so subtle, they were so careful that they, in a very conspicuous way, colluded together and threw in little comments here and there and gave these little incidental details to explain one another and raise questions in one gospel that could only be answered in another. And they did this in dozens of places throughout the gospels. Do you see the contradiction? These are two competing claims. Which is it? Were they too stupid to recognize basic contradictions, which I don't believe in? Or were they so sly and subtle that they were able to sneak these through? I believe that these are undesigned coincidences. That's the power of this. You read these, I mean, as a Bible reader, I'm sure many people here have been reading the Bible for decades, never noticed this. That's how subtle they are. And yet, when looked at closely, they have great evidential weight, in my estimation. Many of these cases of interlocking are between the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. Now, in scholarship today, they're always trying to pit John against the synoptics. That's what they call them, the synoptics. They see together, and John's out here. Here's examples where John is explaining Matthew and Mark and Luke are explaining John. It's awesome. It shows how these two come together. The weaknesses of this argument would be this, in my estimation. This could easily be overstated. Like all evidential apologetics, it's easy to say the only explanation is that they were eyewitnesses, or this proves that the entirety of the New Testament is true. I believe we should say something like, this gives good evidence to believe these were eyewitnesses. This shows that the reliability of the Gospels is increased. And just not overstate it. The evidence is good enough as it is. You don't need to puff it up. This could overwhelm a biblically illiterate person. Even for those of us here who are Bible readers, I'm blustering through. And then John 18 and Mark 10 and a person could just be very confused as to what you're saying. So that could be a potential weakness. It also involves some subjectivity, to be sure. I mean, when we look at these different accounts, is that really undesigned? Is it possible that he could have picked those up? I'm not saying all these are equal. I'm saying that as we make a case here, we discover there's too many of these to be ignored. Some are stronger than others, to be sure. The strengths of the argument, I believe, are manifold. For one, it's a cumulative case. I really like arguments that are cumulative. It isn't that you're trying to come in with one killer point. It's that you're coming in with 30 points. And so even if you could knock out a third of those, you still have 20 that go through that say, this is showing the characteristics and features of eyewitness testimony. This shows that multiple authors were viewing the same events. You know, this is not the sort of thing that you would find in fiction, fabrication, or the accretion of legend over time. That's become real popular in critical circles, that the Gospels were just stories that were passed on to one another from one person to the next, and then they were eventually brought together, and then the Gospel authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they wrote to certain audiences for certain reasons, and some of that's true, but they give the perspective with all this redaction, is what they call it, and bringing together the sources and rewriting it and making it specific to an audience, that it's like we can't really know what happened because there's been all of this legend and accretion and fiction all thrown in together in all these stories. This is not the features of a legendary account. These are the features of people who are actually there seeing the same event. This was formerly required training for pastors in England and the United States. Back in the 1800s, this was standard apologetics training. You had to have this. Why did it go away? It isn't that this argument has ever been defeated. It's just that it's been forgotten. People stopped using it. Why? My suspicion is that because many New Testament scholars have moved away from the idea that the Gospels are inerrant, and they do fit together. And so the idea that the four Gospels do fit together, and we would expect to find that, really has been thrown to the wayside. Instead, much New Testament scholarship has gotten into genre and all sorts of different forms of criticism, and so they're not expecting this. When in reality, I think this argument is so good because these accounts are really true. I think we should bring this back. Also, just from a devotional level, I did a Harmony of the Gospels myself, and I found this really powerful to read the Gospels, and instead of having flat, two-dimensional pictures of Jesus and Peter, when you start to put all four of these together, you get a really vibrant, robust, three-dimensional picture of these characters, and it's often pretty cool. I'd be going home talking to my wife, and be like, look at this. No wonder he dropped his nets. You talked to him over here. And she was like, shut up. Okay, I get it. But I find it to be really cool to be able to see this stuff really happened, and these characters become really flesh and blood. And I think the best way to use this would not be to give an hour-long presentation, actually, because it actually could just put people to sleep. But the way you could use this in ministry is that you could bring these up as you teach through a gospel. Every week, you could be bringing in an undesigned coincidence. It takes about a minute and just show, huh, isn't that funny? Isn't that interesting? And it basically shows that these accounts are the real deal. Well, that's all I had, but I just wanted to point out a couple of further resources. I shamelessly stole basically everything I just shared with you from this book, Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospel and Acts by Lydia McGrew. This book is awesome. Do yourself a favor, spend the $10 and buy this book and read it. She basically just goes through one after another after another. Lydia McGrew herself stole from her husband, Timothy McGrew. These are two academics. They're both PhDs and professors. He's a chess master. A 2100 rating chess master. Their daughter is the best chess player in the state of Michigan. I would love to be at their family dinners. That just seemed like a brilliant, freakishly brilliant family, and good communicators, good writing, and godly people too. Anyways, they stole from J.J. Blunt as well as William Paley. William Paley was the guy who came up with the design argument from a couple centuries ago. I would just tell you, if you're wanting to get started here, one of the best things to do is just to pick up a good Harmony of the Gospels. And I would suggest picking up Stephen Cox's and Kendall Easley's Harmony of the Gospels. It's very conservative. They give good explanations on how to harmonize And if you have any kind of Bible software, one of the things that's nice is you can get your translation that you prefer. Like I prefer the NASB. Other people prefer something else, but it's nice because you can actually look at these side by side. And just reading the accounts for yourself, one of the things that Lydia McGrew says is there's more of these out there to be discovered. And as you start to read the Bible with this lens, you start to discover more and more.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.